Everybody, welcome back to the Badgerland Birding Podcast, bringing you birding news and stories from the Badger State and beyond. Today, we're talking with Holly Garrod, coordinator of the Caribbean Bird Banding Network with Birds Caribbean, who is coming to us live from the island of Grenada. How's it going, Holly?
Hey, Derek, it's going good. Glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me on.
Yeah, of course. So, can you tell us a little bit about what you're doing and, how you ended up in the Caribbean, as I'm sure many of our listeners wish they were right now?
Grenada is definitely an island paradise. So I'm currently actually I'm in Grenada. We're doing our annual Caribbean bird banding workshop. So essentially what we do is we invite people from all over the Caribbean, so typically Caribbean biologists, residents of the Caribbean who are working with wildlife, working with birds, who want to learn more about the technique of bird banding, which is putting a ring on a bird for individual identification. And so we bring them to an island every year, this year in Grenada, and then we spend about a week where we go through different bird banding practices, different training techniques, and especially like focusing a lot on the ethics of bird handling, ethics of bird banding, a lot of safety. And so essentially we just really want to make sure we train people really well. But with bird banding, you can't really learn it in a week because it's a fairly technical skill. So then what we do is we set people up for internships. So these could be they're typically abroad, in the US and Canada, but we're working with partners in Mexico, Belize. Some partners of ours just opened up a bird observatory in Trinidad and Tobago. So hopefully as we capacitate and train more people in the Caribbean, we'll kind of be able to start doing more Caribbean exchanges. And then ideally those people return to their island, start developing a bird banding program. And then we can either kind of work with their local organization to do a more island specific training, or we send a trainer down to kind of work with them. So that's kind of how we're building this Caribbean bird banding network.
Yeah, that's super cool. People have been doing bird banding for a really long time, but for like the average person, can you explain just a little bit about what data you can gather from actually putting the band on?
Oh yeah, for sure. So what's really cool with bird banding, of course with the basics of bird banding are you are putting this little ring on a bird that will uniquely identify that individual for the rest of its life. But while you have a bird in the hand, you're kind of able to take advantage of all this other data you can get. So a lot of times we're looking at breeding condition. And so with our migratory birds, right, we're usually not going to look for breeding condition in the Caribbean because most of those birds are breeding in the US and Canada. But for a lot of the resident birds, we're still trying to understand a lot of the phenology, so the timing of their breeding seasons. So we'll often look for breeding characteristics. So that could be like an engorged cloaca, which we often see in males, or a kind of a bare patch for incubation, which we usually see in females, but some males will also incubate. So we can look for breeding characteristics is one thing. We can also look at body condition. So one of the really cool things with birds is they have a fairly translucent skin. So you can actually see their fat deposits. And so you can actually see their fat stored above the muscle, but below the skin. And it kind of looks like that yellowish, yellow color, like when you're cutting a raw chicken breast. And so we can quantify how much fat birds have, and that's often an indicator of habitat, right? So if we see birds that are putting on a lot more fat, to be an indicator that the birds are getting the nutrients they need, especially for birds that are overwintering or using islands as stopover sites. So seeing birds get a lot of fat is great to see. We also look at molt, so how birds replace their feathers, and looking at kind of the timing of that, especially in relation to breeding. So molt is something that also helps us understand age of birds, because birds molt in certain patterns. And so oftentimes we can age birds by looking at if the bird is within their first year, so if they still have some juvenile feathers, or if they're adults. So kind of with that, we're able to looking at molt that can relate to looking at age. And then with age, we can start to understand demography. So we can start looking at, are we seeing more populations of older birds versus younger birds? Are we seeing younger birds being born? Are we seeing a lot of younger birds kind of hatching out this time of year? So we can definitely get a really good look at demography. And then of course, one of the really cool things with bird banding is like with the bird band itself, that's kind of the way we know longevity of a lot of birds, because as we recapture birds year after year, that's how we can know how long birds live. So even tiny birds like a Wilson's warbler, we can actually find that they can live up to 10 years, which you might think a tiny like 10 gram bird that migrates between Canada and Costa Rica might live only 2 to 3 years. But yeah, I've had recaptures personally of 10-year-old birds, so.
That's awesome. I've heard that kind of, when you go to like the Cornell Lab of Ornithology site, they'll have like the expected age. I've heard that through bird banding, people have found that those are like way shorter than probably most of those birds can actually live. So it's really neat to see those findings. Do you guys put the, so you do the federal band, that's like the silver one, and then do you guys do any other colors too?
So with the color banding, that typically tends to be more like study specific.
Okay.
So it tends to be, so I did actually, so I got my start in the Caribbean. I was studying the Caribbean toadies, which is what I have tattooed on my shoulder
That's
here.
cool.
Yeah. And so I was studying if the, so Hispaniola is, so I guess real quick toad, this is my quick toadie intro, but
Perfect.
yeah, so toadies are a Caribbean endemic family. They're these adorable little green birds that look like hummingbirds, but are actually more related to kingfishers. So there's five in the Caribbean, one on the greater, one on each of the Greater Antilles, except for Hispaniola, which has two. And so because Hispaniola is the only island with two toadies, I was really curious to study if these toadies hybridize. And so that was how I got my start, was studying hybridizing toadies. And we actually did find the first toady hybrid, which was really cool. And yeah, so I was studying, kind of looking at like, do they hybridize? How could they hybridize? Like looking at playback experiments and doing morphology. And so what I was doing is I was color banding the toadies so I could recognize individuals. So I could see kind of, because they also make like little burrow nests, like kingfishers. So then I would see like, okay, who's in which burrow? Do they visit each other's burrow? Who responds to the different playbacks? And so a lot of times color banding is more for recognizing individuals that you don't have to recapture.
That's really cool. Did you guys, so you guys found the first hybrid?
Yeah, we did. And what was really cool, so the broad-billed and narrow-billed toady are the two toadies on Hispaniola. And so the toady we found, so actually a Dominican biologist, Miguel Landestoy, he found it and showed it to me. And then I helped confirm it was a hybrid. And honestly, to me, the biggest selling point is that the vocalization was is completely intermediate. So with the broad-billed toady, they make this kind of like beep, beep, beep. And the narrow-billed toady makes this more insect-like ch-ch-ch. And then this hybrid toady made this like, ch ch but it would like at the same intervals as the broad-billed toady, but then it like in like more of the tonation of the narrow-billed toady. Like it was wild. It was a completely intermediate vocalization. And so they're not a song learning species either. So if you have a species with an innate vocalization, so essentially being born knowing how to make that song, then you would also kind of infer like, okay, well, a hybrid would have a genetic, like a, its vocalization would reflect its genotype. And so what was really cool too is we caught it and banded it. We gave it some color bands and some color or some playback experiments on it. And then it all the morphometrics were completely intermediate. So you have broad build, narrow build, and then this was like intermediate build toady, which is really cool.
Huh. That's weird that those two would, like, if they have those distinct calls, then decide to mate, you know, with each other, and just like hearing that
Yeah.
completely different one being like, oh, slightly different toady. Did
Slightly different.
you guys get to name it or something? Is it like Holly's intermediate toady or something? That'd be
I
cool.
don't know. Yeah, I'm actually still working on like that was my master's thesis, so I still need to publish that. I don't think I get to name it, but one thing I thought would be really fun if I did, it would be Totus enormis, because I just think that would be really fun because it is a really cute toady.
Yeah, that's neat. So where did you do your master's?
So I did my master's at Villanova, outside of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. But so I spent kind of the school year there, and then I would go down to Dominican Republic for my fields season. So that usually be, and that I would kind of coincide perfectly with the toady breeding season. So it was typically like May through August.
That's neat. And I was gonna mention with the banning and stuff too. It's really helpful if birders are out and they see a band to report that stuff.
Definitely.
What's the site they can go to report bands they see?
Yeah, so you can go to reportaband.org. Or honestly, there's also some forums on Facebook where you can usually report bands, and there's like some a lot of bird banding forums. And if you and like I've done it too. I think I was in Paris a few years ago on a layover, and I found some crows with like pretty obvious like large bands that you could read from a camera. And so I like took the photo and uploaded it to a Facebook group. I was like, hey, anyone know these crows? And someone did, like everyone
You're
all
like,
over,
whose crow is this?
whose crow is this? Yeah. But like people, it's a small, the banding world is, the birding world is not that big. The banding world is even smaller, so.
Yeah, that's neat. So which all Caribbean islands have you been to so far?
Okay, so I'm most familiar with Hispaniola, specifically Dominican Republic. So I spent quite a bit of time there, like 5 years on and off doing my master's, and I try to visit every year. I went to Cuba last year. to lead a bird banding workshop or help lead a bird banding workshop. And then I was in Jamaica and Puerto Rico last year doing some modus tagging with Birds Caribbean. So part of our project is modus tagging Swainson's warblers in Jamaica and prairie warblers in Puerto Rico, though we didn't have as much luck in Puerto Rico. And then what's really cool, Birds Caribbean does these biannual conferences. So this year we'll actually be in Dominican Republic, which will give me a good excuse to go back. But a few years ago it was in Guadeloupe, so I got to go to Guadeloupe, which was pretty neat. And then this year I also was able to visit Trinidad, which is a big bucket list, and then Grenada, which is also a new island for me. And I think that's, yeah, that's it. But I don't know, it's cool. I'm hoping to keep hopping around because there's some really cool endemics in the Caribbean.
Yeah, do you love Grenada?
Grenada's cool. Yeah, I did a dive the other day. The diving was amazing. We went to Mount Hartman Park this morning and we heard the Grenada dove, which is
Nice,
critically
awesome.
endangered. Yeah. Think there's only like less than 160 doves they're estimating right
Not
now.
many,
And
yeah.
yeah, so that was like pretty, and they just have such a sad call too. It's like, ooh, like it's like, oh, poor guys. So it's been cool. And the Grenada has the all black banana quits too, which are really cool. The
Yeah,
like mystic ones, yeah.
So Grenada and Jamaica are the two Caribbean places I've been to, spent the most time in Grenada, but I love that it
Okay.
doesn't feel as touristy. It kind
Yeah.
of just it is like this island paradise where you're just like, ah, no, like no, there's no tourist kind of vibe. It's just more island life and
Yeah.
locals and beaches and Grenada doves.
Grenada doves, but totally. I was actually noticing that. It's funny because I notice a few cruise ships will come in, but then the people will all be very concentrated in one area. And I've just been like, I don't know, I've just been going all over and everywhere else. It just really doesn't feel that touristy. And I was on the beach after a dive and it was like empty. And I was like, wow, this is like having a white sand beach to myself is so cool. So yeah, I'm absolutely loving it here.
Yeah. Can you give us some like island rankings of which Caribbean island's your favorite or which is the most like, some like superlatives for
Oh my
if people
gosh.
might
Okay.
want to
This is,
visit?
yeah, this is, I mean, I would, so of course I would have to go Dominican Republic is one of the top ones. And what my, here's my main spiel. Everyone in Dominican Republic always goes to the southwest part of the island when they come for birding, which is fair because you can usually clean up most of the endemics and then kind of like scoot on over to Punta Cana for the Ridgeway's hawk. But I propose that I did my work in the center part of the region in Jarabacoa, which is a really beautiful little mountain town. And I found like the Cordillera Central there. Like, I just think there's just so much that's waiting to be discovered. And the thing is with Dominican Republic is it's a chronically underbirded country. Like, you don't have that many people doing ornithology. They actually, unfortunately, just lost one of their really awesome ornithologists a couple weeks ago, or very recently, like maybe less than a week ago. Simone, and he was like leading the way in a lot of like he was making a lot of nest boxes, and so but you don't have a ton of people doing ornithology, and you don't have a lot of birders. You get a lot more photographers, but then you get this like crazy bias where the people who are coming down to bird are usually North Americans who come during the winter, and they all go to the Southwest. So you just have these like vast swaths of like underbirded regions in the country. So while you can clean up the endemics in the Southwest, I'm pretty sure that if you just started birding the Cordillera Central hard, like, and a lot of it is hard to bird just because, like, it is a lot of like private land ownerships. And so, part of the reason I did a lot of my work there is I ended up getting to know a lot of landowners. I still know a lot of people in the country. But for instance, I know this one guy who, so there's a scientific reserve called Ebano Verde, and probably like in the center of the country, like near Jarabacoa. And around it, they have this buffer zone that's an area where like they really discourage people from growing crops, and like they're like really trying to like, keep it more natural and reforest it. And I ended up meeting a guy who's a property owner. He owns this beautiful property called La Serena, right in the buffer zone. So La Serena being like the serene. And he has the most consistent spot for white-fronted quail dove I have ever found. Like, it is almost always there. And that is a bird that is so hard to see in that country. So I just think if you started birding that central part of the country more, like, I think you could start finding the white-winged warbler, which isn't really a warbler, or also known as the Hispaniola and Highland Tanager. I think you could find, I don't know if you could get the cua, the bay-breasted cuckoo, but you could probably, I think you could maybe find a Lascelles thrush like way up there. But I don't know. I just think that just it's chronically underbirded. And that's my number one. More people need to bird there.
I think you need to start doing tours there because you sounded
Yeah.
so passionate about
Go
that, like where people should go. I'm like, just go with Holly, go
there.
there, find the cool stuff.
I can give you the local Dominican experience.
Yeah, you I know that you've been there a lot when you slip into like the little when people slip into like the Spanish accent pronunciation of certain words. I'm like, yep, they're experienced.
Yeah, thanks. But yeah, I guess to continue answering your question, so I would 100% recommend Dominican Republic. Come with me to see if you experience the
There
Cordillera
you go.
Central. But oh man, Cuba is really amazing. Like, Cuba's incredible, but I know it is difficult for Americans to travel, and they are having it's like it's kind of sad in Cuba because there's just not a lot of fuel in the country. Like, a friend of mine
Oh.
was just at one of our workshops, and she was telling me that she couldn't even go banding because they like didn't have enough gas to get to the banding sites. So
Is there a
Cuba's beautiful.
thing?
What?
Is there a thing with Cuba where they have like a bunch of old cars?
Yeah.
So
So
it's
like
like feels like you're in the, I don't know what time period that would be, 60s, 70s,
it's
80s, maybe
like
before
the
that.
60s. Yeah.
60s.
So that's kind of it's wild. So Havana's really cool. The birding Cuba and the beaches are amazing. I don't know, there's so many good ones. I really enjoyed Jamaica too. Jamaica has So I'm gluten intolerant. So anytime I can eat pretty successfully on an island, I'm like, woo, pretty excited. And Jamaica has bami, which are like these tiny little breads made of cassava or like yuca flour. And I was sold. I was like, oh, come here back, like just for the bami and the jerk chicken. Like, the food was amazing. The toadies were amazing. Jamaican toadie was a good one.
Have you seen
Yeah.
all the toadies? I'm
I have
assuming.
seen all the toadies,
Okay.
and I have banded four of the five toadies,
You
which I
know,
do.
well, you've seen the hybrid too. So you may be one person in the world who's seen the most toady species.
This is true. Yeah. So, oh, okay. And I would have to say Trinidad. Trinidad is like, I have to go back to the island. It's amazing. I missed the Mott-Mott, which is my last Mott-Mott to see,
Which
sadly.
one is there?
The Trinidad Mott-Mott.
Oh,
The
yep.
Pro tip, you have to go to Tobago to see it, is what I learned. And I
You're
was like,
like,
I have no
oh
plans
man.
to go to Tobago. So yeah, unfortunately I dipped on that one. But it just means I have to go back. And so I would highly, highly recommend Trinidad and Tobago. Amazing country, such nice people, and the birding there was spectacular.
I feel like for a lot of people, kind of birding in the Caribbean seems a little overwhelming just because there's so many places that you could go. And like you said,
Yeah.
with certain areas, they're not birded that often. So I kind of feel like going there, at least people in the US, I think we're used to going to like South Texas or Arizona where you kind of know what expected species are there. People have been there, they can kind of give you the lowdown. But going to some of those Caribbean places does feel kind of like uncharted waters where you're not necessarily sure where to find everything. You don't want to go on like private property. I know in Grenada they drive on the other side of the road because it
Yeah.
was colonized by Britain. So it's a lot of things. You don't drive, do you drive in Grenada?
I haven't driven in Grenada, but we did. So, funny story, when we did our some work in Jamaica last year to tag the Swainson's Warblers, we rented a field vehicle to get up to Holywell, and my colleague and friend was like, yeah, Holly, so like you're, because I'm like, when I drive in the Dominican Republic, man, I am like Caribbean driver. I'm like cruising through. I'm like real confident. And so she's like, yeah, you gotta drive. Cause she's like, I can't handle Kingston. And I was like, okay. But it was my first time driving on the other side of the road. So I was like, she was like, holy, you're drifting. You're drifting. And so I was terrified. And then we were going up to Holywell, and we get to this fork in the road. And we're like looking on Google Maps, because it's a really windy road up there. We're looking at Google Maps, and we're like, well, this side like isn't as windy. This side's like way windier. We're like, let's go to the less windy one. And what we didn't know is that wasn't like a real road. It was just like this back entrance to Holywell. And so we were going up it, and we were like, wow, road's like getting kind of rough. And then we were going up, and it became like this single track road. And we were like, okay, like, yeah. And I was like, it's too late now. I was like, and it's like, it was like 8 p.m. or something. And I
Oh
was like,
man.
I'm committed. Like, we're just going, man. And so I was like, we're not turning around. And so we just kept going up. And then we hit a truck. And I was like, I'm not backing down. And like, I was like, I'll just wait. And then the truck pulled over, and we kept going. And then we kept going and kept going. And it was like pretty rough road. And so like driving on like the like what to me is the passenger side. And then we get and we see like the sign for Holywell. We like pass it. We're like, oh wow, like that was not on the road back We just like went through the back way, and we told the our colleagues we were meeting up with, because they were like, how's your first night in Jamaica go? And I was like, well, we kind of took the back way through Hollywell. And they're like, if you can drive that, Holly, they're like, you are good to drive in this country. And I was like, whew, thanks. So it was
Yeah,
wild.
I feel like, well, one, how freaked out were you guys when it was dark and you're like, this road's really bad and
Yeah, like I think I was like holding, I was like, it's fine, guys. But we were all definitely a little freaked out for sure. Especially when you're like, oh, this is like, is this a real road? Like, we don't know.
Yeah, I feel like driving on the other side, I feel like I would definitely try to just go the other way. And just be like, this
Yeah.
doesn't feel right. You'd have to reassure yourself like every 10 seconds that you're doing the right thing.
I know. I was talking to a friend of mine who lives in Trinidad, and she was like, the key is you always have to think it's like the drivers are close to each other. The driver's in the middle of the road. And I was like, that helps. So,
Because the wheel's on the other side, right? Okay. Yeah, I don't know. That's
I
weird.
don't know.
Have you had, besides that one, have you had any sketchy experiences in your travels?
In the Caribbean,
Or just in general?
just in general. Oh, yeah. I mean, even so, where I was staying in Grenada, actually, like a few days ago, I'm always like a very budget traveler, and working for a nonprofit, you don't make a ton of money. And I mean, there's no money in conservation. So, the group, Birds Caribbean, was like, yeah, just like try to find a cheap hotel. And I was like, yeah, sure. So I found this like really cheap Airbnb for like $30 a night. And it was behind a bar. And then I mean, I'm like a small white girl alone too. And so when I get there, and I read the reviews and everything, the reviews are like, oh, it's really nice. And I was like, oh, okay. But I get there and the lady hands me the key. She's like, yeah, you're gonna wanna always keep this locked because the bathroom's over here. She's like, sometimes drunk people get really confused about your door in the bathroom. And I was like, cool, great start.
You're like, that's going on the review. That should be maybe the first thing they put on.
Yeah, and you could hear the door jingling at
Oh,
night. I was
no.
like, oh, that's not fun. And then yeah, I just ended up getting like real harassed. Like I got like followed around. And then it was like a combination of like I had one guy like stop his car and be like, get in so I can take you out. And I was like, no, thank you. And then I had some guys being like, go back to your cruise ship. And I was like, I'm not going to a cruise ship. So it just was a lot of it was a little intense. I mean, it was a cool way, I think, to know a different part of the island, and I was like shopping at real local grocery stores, and I definitely had some really good food, but it was outside my comfort zone for sure. And so I ended up, and it was behind a bar, so I got to listen to soca music till 3 a.m. But which so I guess we should be lucky I moved, because otherwise you might not be hearing
Yeah,
me
we'd
as
be
well.
getting copyright strikes for sure on that.
Honestly, I have a million wild stories from all the places I've worked and traveled.
It sounds like it. How did you start to get into that? 'Cause I'm sure like what you do is a lot of people's like dream jobs of, you know. So where are you when you're not in the Caribbean then?
So I guess what I typically do is I call myself a migratory bird because I really hate winter. And so the way it kind of works is I do like contract jobs, and so I work as the coordinator for the Caribbean Bird Banding Network for Birds Caribbean, but then I also take contracts. So like people will ask me to teach a bird banding workshop here or help out with a project here. And so I used to live in Ecuador. So I lived in Ecuador for a year running a bird observatory. And then I lived in Costa Rica for 3 years. A year and a half of that, I was like helping run the Costa Rica Bird Observatory before it unfortunately doesn't exist anymore. But because of that, I have a lot of connections and projects in those countries. So like a friend of mine was like, hey, do you want to do a bird workshop in Ecuador with me? And I was like, heck yeah, because then I get to see some of my old friends in Ecuador. And same in Costa Rica, I'm kind of still part of some projects, even though the bird observatory is no longer around. I still kind of know some of the people banding, and they really like to hire me. So then the way it kind of works is I kind of end up bouncing around until usually like May, and then I'll go up. I'm currently renting a room in Montana, and I have some awesome roommates who are taking care of my parakeet right now. So then I'll spend the summer in
What's
Montana, and
yeah, all right, one, what's your parakeet name?
yeah, my parakeet's name is Bijou. She's a green-cheeked parakeet or green-cheeked conure.
Nice. So as I was saying, I feel like that, like a lot of people listening, that's probably like their dream job, like live in the US and then in the, cold months go and do bird stuff. So if anyone wanted to do that, like what's your recommendation for how they would go about getting some kind of job like that?
My recommendation is, so let's see, my recommendation is to find remote work. And then, because honestly, most of what I do is remote work. So yes, especially Birds Caribbean, I get to do some workshops, and we do have some projects that I'll help with, like with the tagging. So I tend to help with a lot more of the like bird handling projects. And since we have like the Caribbean Bird Banding Network, like I'm working to expand that to other taxa because I'm kind of a passerine bias person. But honestly, most of that work is remote. So that's kind of what allows me that to go and take other like mini gigs and do kind of like other workshops. Or like I have friends now in like Costa Rica, and to be like, hey, can I just like come hang in Costa Rica for a few weeks? And they'll be like, sure, and I'll just do my remote work. So honestly, my best advice for people is to find remote work, because there really is not, there are not a lot of paying jobs for wildlife biologists, especially in birds south of the border, I've found. And honestly, it's like I've worked for pennies just because I love what I do, and I love not living in the US a lot of times. So yeah, I think that's yeah, that's my best advice, is to find remote work, or be okay, like if you do remote work and then you can volunteer on different wildlife projects, I think that's kind of the way, that's like the best way. And then the more you volunteer, though, usually the way it works, right, is you have to like volunteer a lot, and the more you volunteer, then you can kind of like work your way up to get a little bit of money and a little bit more, a little bit more. And that's, unfortunately, it's not the best, but it's kind of the way wildlife work seems to go.
Yeah, is that something you see changing in the future, or do you think it's always going to kind of be like that?
I think that's a good question. I think it depends. Like a lot of, so it's like a combination of things, right? Because like a lot of what I do, especially, is like I really focus on giving, like empowering local people and giving local people the power that they can run their own bird monitoring workshop, because I don't think there's been enough of that. Like, I think there is this, a lot of people will do what I did, where they like do a PhD or a master's abroad, and they'll do it in the Caribbean or they'll do it in Costa Rica, but then they'll take that data and they'll leave. And so that's what's called like parachute science, or colonial science. And right, because you're just kind of like coming in, you're using that, you're like taking that data, and then you're just like, all right, well, bye. And so one of the things I really wanted to do to work against that is like I really worked with local schools. I did a lot of outreach while I did my master's. I kind of like hired all local techs, except I had a couple volunteers. So I think there's one aspect of it that we have to get like more local involvement, and we have to make sure we're paying local people. Because like even in Costa Rica, like a friend of mine's a biologist there, and she and I were talking about how basically like she, as a Tico biologist, she can't find a lot of work, because like they, you can just like foreigners will work for like a third of the wage, of the living wage of like what Costa Ricans would need. And like we're Costa Ricans, you have to pay more because you're also paying into like the CAHA, which is like the national health insurance. So then conservation organizations are less incentivized to hire local people, because you can just get a foreigner to come and work for a third of the price, and you can just like pay them pennies and give them a place to live, and they'll be happy. And so it's just like this weird, like I think there needs to be a balance with making sure local people have that empowerment to like run those local programs, and also yeah, and like empowered to run that local programs and have a job doing that conservation work that, you know, like they clearly care about. But then I think there is still this place that like hopefully there would be more money to pay people who have like dedicated their lives to like more science and conservation. But I just think it's tough because I don't know, there's no money in conservation. I get really, so I'll try not to be too pessimistic. I get a little pessimistic because there's no money in conservation, and it's less so the when you go further south of the border. So I do think the model that does seem to work a lot of times is people that have more like regular jobs and want to take a break, or people that earn like work for consulting firms or like earn a lot of money, then can like kind of take that money and reinvest it in like some of these kind of volunteer programs where you might pay to stay, but all that money is going straight back into conservation and paying local biologists. So I don't know, it's like an interesting mix.
Yeah,
Hopefully that wasn't too complicated.
oh no, you're good. I'm kind of hoping as birding becomes more of a thing the average person's aware of, we get more of that, more of having birding be more of a career, or more of like, being a conservation career, having, birding influencers type deal, where it is more of a thing that you can make a career out of, because it is pretty tough. to be passionate about birding, and it's kind of like, well, what are your options? You can guide or you can go into research. Right now, those are kind of like the two main things that you can try to do. So I'm hoping that that kind of expands for more people in the future, and that there are more opportunities for like bird related stuff, because it is kind of a sad feeling, even being in like the fisheries biology world. It's kind of like, well, you can either like be out in the field and not make a ton of money, or you can be like management, not go in the field, but you make more money. So it's tough. My advisor was like, sadly, the further up you go, the less time you actually spend out in the field and the more time you spend in your office.
It's totally true though, and like I see it too with like more and more of my friends who we all did undergrad and did field jobs together. Now we're all getting higher up a little bit. We're like, oh no, we don't go to the field as much as we used to. We're like, and you definitely, and that's why we all got into it, right? Because we all love being outside, being in the field, and then yeah, I don't know. That's just how that's the cycle right now, I guess.
Yeah. What are some of your favorite places from Costa Rica? Because Costa Rica is incredible.
Oh, Costa Rica is amazing. I mean, I'm always biased because I'm very fortunate that one of the projects I help run, or I help with, is in the Osa Peninsula.
Oh
And
man,
Costa
that's cool.
Peninsula, it is the gem of Costa Rica, honestly. And we are working with the community in Rancho Quemado and then in Dos Brazos de Rio Tigre, both of which are just awesome. Dos Brazos has a little bit more of like a guiding community, but the community in Rancho Quemado is like this group of women, and one of the ladies, Yolanda, who kind of like leads the charge, they just like have this whole volunteer project where they all monitor the peccaries, which is incredible. And they just like, some of them will spend like 12 hours up at night just like making sure the peccaries don't get hunted, and they have like protected the peccaries so well. So that is like, and Rancho Quemado is just beautiful. Like there's just like, there's like in the mornings it'll be like really misty, and there'll be like these gorgeous sunrises, and you can get the endemic black-cheeked ant tanager there. So the we were actually that was part of the work we were doing too, is we were starting like a bird banding project and then also doing some work monitoring the black-cheeked ant tanagers because not much has been done with them. So definitely OSA is amazing. The highlands are pretty cool too,
I
honestly.
love the
Like
Highlands.
they're so neat, like Cerrado de Lota. I did a bunch of work near there in like the Madre Selva field station. And it's what I love about the highlands is like you get these little microclimates. So you can be one place in the Talamancas, and you can get this like community of birds. And literally, and we see this right at our banding station, we would be banding in one place. You go a kilometer down the road and the avian community just shifts. Like it's just like enough in elevation that we'd go from getting like mostly one of the nightingale thrushes to completely getting the other one. Like it was just, we're getting like more, it was like one site we would sometimes get to the violet ear, and then the other site, boom, it would just be like all fiery-throated hummingbirds. Like it was wild.
Yeah, so when I went, it was with a school group where I was doing my master's program.
Oh,
So it was
cool.
like I went as a grad student, but we had a bunch of like undergrads and teachers. And when we stayed in the Highlands, everyone, I don't think they were prepared for just how cold it gets there. So like we
Oh, it's
were up there
cold.
and they were freezing. I think I was wearing my like winter jacket to bed, but I had so much fun in the Highlands. But I think most of them, they weren't as into nature, and they were just like, it's cold. I don't like it up here.
Yeah, so where we used to have the Costa Rica, like one of the main field stations was up in the Highlands. And I had a friend of mine come visit me who's living in Seattle. And I was like, yeah, come visit. I was like, but was like, it's gonna be chilly. Like, make sure you bring jackets, like bring sweaters. And she's like, oh, it's Costa Rica. And I was like, no, like I'm serious. Like, bring jackets and sweaters. And she like kind of listened to me. But then we got up and she was like, holy, the weather is the same as Seattle. It is like cold and rainy and windy. And I was like, yeah, but the
Yeah.
birds are doing
Yeah, the Highland birds are so cool.
great. So they're so
With OSA, I remember hearing the stat, it has it's a peninsula, it's 0.00000085% of the Earth's surface, and it contains 2.5% of the entire planet's biodiversity. That is
Yeah, isn't
just
that
a wild
crazy?
stat.
It's insane. It's honestly like one of the wildest places you can go in Costa Rica. You'll have like scarlet macaws will fly over you, and like we had a net like a nesting colony of swallowtail kites too. And yeah, it's amazing there.
Yeah, really neat place. What are some of your favorite birds that you've banded?
Oh man, another good
Was there
question.
ever like a really weird one? Did you ever get like a great egret go in your net or anything?
Sometimes. So the thing is, it's like when you're misnetting the way I do with like a typical bird banding effort, your nets are about like 12 meters long and 2.5 meters high. And you're typically kind of going more for those like understory, mid-story birds that would fly within that kind of height range. So you don't typically get really like higher like canopy birds or anything. But you do like sometimes, especially like the nets. So the nets are also like the mesh size is designed more for smaller birds, right? So like passerines. So like the birds that get caught are going to be more of like your warblers and sparrows and thrushes. But because it is a pocket, the larger birds can sometimes be in the pocket. So I think two of the weirdest ones, actually last year in Costa Rica in the Osa Peninsula, the banders like called me because so I've been kind of like training them and like they're all Costa Rican and I've been like training them to kind of like run their own station. But they called me and they're like, "Holly, Holly, we have a tiny hawk in the net." And so I was like, "Whoa, that's really cool." And so I like ran up to go see it. And a tiny hawk would be like kind of expected. It's passerine size.
But it's just a small hawk. Like it's just
It's a
a.
small hawk. Yeah, it
I
is
gotta look this
tiny
up.
hawk. Probably around the size of a sharp-shinned, honestly. But I get up to the net and I was like, "Huh, like looks kind of different." I was like, I was like, "And but I've never seen a tiny hawk before." And I know what they look like from guides and stuff, but I was like, "Well," I was like, "this really does." I was like, "This thing's huge." I was like, "Are you sure this is a tiny hawk?" And the Yolanda was like, "Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's a tiny hawk." And she was like, "What else are we gonna miss that?" And I was like, "Okay." And so we like pull it out and we ban and it's a big raptor. And then I'm looking at it, I'm like, "This isn't a tiny hawk, this is a double-toothed kite." Like,
Oh, wow.
yeah, which you like they really don't go that low. And it was like a juvenile double-toothed kite. So that was really quite wild. Another wild one, when I was in Ecuador. So I lived in Ecuador and I used to run this Jamaicuaque Bird Observatory for about like 10 months. And at one point they took me to Mindo and they're like, "Yeah, we want to try out this new banding site in Mindo." So we threw up some nets. And so a friend of mine was with me and we like went to go check the nets and we got a sunbittered in a net. And the
Wow.
wildest thing, it got away, unfortunately,
Oh,
but it was
that's
funny
like
because we
going
caught it.
fishing and it breaks the line kind of deal.
Really?
Oh, I mean, that's what it reminds me of. I'd be like, I had this epic fish on and it got away, but bird style.
Exactly. No, it's totally like that. And this one was funny because you know how with sunbitterns they have these like big, like when they're kind of like trying to spook something, they'll like kind of open their wings and it'll look like these big eye spots. So we saw this larger bird in the net and I was like, "Oh, something big, like let's go." Because if you get a large bird, they can like bounce out. So you kind of want to kind of like sneak up and like grab it. And so we were like trying to sneak up and grab it. But then it totally flashed its wings and it kind of just took my friend aback. And so then she was like, "Wait, what the?" And then it escaped. And I
Dude,
was
it
like, "Ooh,
totally
it
got
worked."
her. Yeah, it
Yeah.
totally got her.
It totally got her.
You gotta, I feel like you can't let that go for her. You'll be like, you got faked out by a sunbittern. Like, if she ever tries to like pull rank on you, just be like, you got faked out by a sunbittern. Like, your
You're
opinion,
like,
it's
"One of
not
us got
valid.
faked out by a sunbittern."
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Those are wild. One thing that we've noticed with bird banding is to people in the science world, it makes a lot of sense and, you know, they can see the value in it and everything. But to the average person, they can be surprisingly against it. Do you know why some people kind of feel that way?
Yeah, so I've come across quite a lot of that. I think a lot of it is people really love birds, right? There's a lot of people who are bird watchers, really like to see the birds in their yard. So sometimes when you're handling a bird, right, people, especially when they see it on social media, people are like, "Oh my gosh, like let the bird go. Like those birds look so stressed." And so I always equate bird banding to like alien abduction, right? Where it's kind of like you're plucking these birds out of their habitat. You're not probing them, but you're like measuring them, giving them a band. And then like I think like there's a great scene in Happy Feet where they're like, "Oh, the aliens got me." I'm like, "Yeah, that's what bird banding is basically." But then you release them. So obviously the birds are like a little discombobulated. Obviously the process, they're not stoked through the whole thing. So there is like an element of stress. But you know what I see too is that like birds, they go right back to normal activity almost immediately after banding. Like sometimes they're a little like, they're like, "What?" And they like preen and fluff up. But like toadies, man, I would release toadies and they're like, "Cool." And they go straight back to eating butterflies and stuff. Like they're like, "All right, time to eat." You know, so I think even though bird banding might look a little odd, and it might, I think that's what people don't like about it, right? Is you're holding this bird sometimes too, if it's not. So I'm a very strict, especially on social media, like really you have to show birds in the best light, because like birds can look stressed, birds do get stressed, like there are some realities of it. You have to show it in the best light. Obviously, like seeing pictures of a bird in a net is stressful. There is also like people in Central America and the Caribbean, there are still problems where people use mist nets to illegally catch birds. So that's why I will never post anything with like a bird in a net, just because it can really easily get misconstrued. I also don't do any selfie posts because I think it really promotes this image of like trophyism, and it doesn't promote like a we're scientifically working with a bird. It's more like, haha, look what I caught. And that's not the point of it. Like it's cool to tell stories about like, well, these are some cool birds we've caught, but it's never like, there's just kind of this difference. And so I do think people can see these things on social media, and I see them all the time. I'll just like search hashtag bird banding. And I don't know, there's just tons of like questionable stuff. And people sometimes think like the band can hurt the bird, or the birds will outgrow the band, which isn't true. Like, I mean, that's how we get longevity records, right? Is like by recapturing these banded birds. So I think it's just kind of dispelling a lot of these myths.
Yeah, I think it's the same as anything else. It's the kind of thing where if it's done right, it doesn't cause any problems. It's kind of like, photographing owls. If people do it right and they do it ethically, it's
Yes.
fine. But if they don't do it, then it kind of ruins the whole thing for everybody. Can we
Yeah,
talk a little bit about
totally.
your Instagram? So
Yeah, totally. I'd
you
love
post a
to.
lot of cool, awesome bird stuff of birds that you guys abandoned, like kind of in the hand, so you get like that close up appreciation of it. And right now you've got over 35,000 followers. So how's kind of been the journey of posting on Instagram,
Thank
and have you
you.
seen a good response of people appreciating the birds that you guys work with?
Yeah, actually, I would say overall, I've seen really positive response. I think like, and one of the things, and one of the reasons, like I really try to make it more, it like was my personal account, and then it just became a SciComm account, and I was like, well, I'm not mad about it. So, because I really love like sharing with people the unique things I find when I'm like, when I'm studying the birds and the unique things I've noticed, and I really love to share my perspective that way. And I really find like with a bird in the hand, like it's just this totally unique perspective. Like sometimes you'll catch a bird and it'll be like a bird you might see like an indigo bunting or a cardinal, and you'll be like, oh my God, it's like way smaller than I thought. Or you're like, wow, this thing is huge. Like there's just like
It's
sometimes
a
the size
double-tooth
from when you're
kite.
looking at the bird. Yeah, like this is a double tooth kite. Exactly. Like the size is just like, it's so different than when you're watching it. I don't know. It's so, I really like kind of showing people that. And then actually, I think my account really kind of grew because I wanted to show people some of the aspects of bird banding. So I wanted to show people like, this is how we can weigh birds. And weighing birds is like the goofiest thing ever, because you basically, a lot of times you like put them upside down in a cup, and the bird's like, okay. And then you like let them go, and they're like, But that honestly, I think that was when it was like, I went viral. But the other, like the funny thing, I just like the internet, man. The other thing that went viral is I caught a white-tipped sicklebill, which is this really cool hummingbird with like a bent bill, right? And we caught one, and I was like, oh, this is cool. And I like, when I try to make these videos, right, I never want to hold the birds for too long. So all the videos are usually like 7 to 15 seconds. This is like a 7 second clip of me holding a hummingbird, and the amount of people that focused on my fingers was insane. Like people were just like commenting nonstop. They're like, why do these girls' fingers look like toes? Like this girl has like toe fingers. I was like, what is this? It was like this weird, and I just thought it was hilarious. Like I was like, whatever, hate on my fingers all you want, I guess. Like,
Maybe
sure. And it
that
got like
ended
7 million.
up maybe that ended up on the wrong side of Instagram.
I
I don't know.
was like, did you not notice how cool this bird is? Like, what? So it's definitely been interesting. And I think that's why I've kind of gotten used to a lot of the comments too, because like you'll get a lot of really cool comments. People are like, wow, this is so awesome. But you'll inevitably get a lot of like, why are you holding these birds? Let these birds go. And then you have to be like, I am a federally licensed and trained person, and I am permitted to do this, and all these birds were released. Like, I would never keep a bird. But you have to be prepared. And to me too, you have to answer people. Because if you don't answer people, especially the people that are like, let the bird go, you're like, I did let the bird go. If you don't, then it's like it just builds, and more people are kind of like, bah. So it's definitely, so I've definitely seen the good and bad of it. Because I do think it's like this amazingly cool perspective. You can really show people this whole other side of birds and be like, look how cool they are. But you also have to be like, don't do this at home, And also, like, we did let them go. So.
Sure. Can people check you out on Instagram? Is that cool?
Oh yeah, for sure. My
So
Instagram
it's
is, oh yeah.
Orn, ORN dot ecology, right?
Yes, correct.
Okay, cool. So we're gonna read some of the comments on one of your latest videos. so that we could get a vibe for what you're talking about. So we got this one is of you holding a blue bunting. Super cool. So it's top one is so bummed I missed this one. He's awesome.
Oh,
That
no.
guy definitely, feeling bad that he's not holding a blue bunting right now. The matching nails, so unappreciated. So that's the other side, the positive in the nails. What a looker. Was it a coincidence that your nails match him? Was it a coincidence?
It was a coincidence. Yeah, it actually was a pure, but that was like my only life for that trip too, so it was a good coincidence.
Yeah. Those indigo nails, though. Yeah, people do talk about your hands a lot.
I
After that
know.
one video, were you like, let me make sure that my hands are always on point? Or did it not change anything?
I know, I was like, I'm getting my nails done. I'm getting my nails done before I go bird banding this time. But yeah, it's funny. People like really like to comment on my hands. I'm like, I don't know what this means, but sure.
So, do you have any destinations you really want to go? Well, okay, two questions, I guess. One is as a bird bander, when you go birding,
Okay.
do you ever see stuff? You're just like, man, I wish I had that bird in the hand instead of looking at it from far away.
Definitely sometimes, especially like, so I'm a big molt nerd, and like the more you get into like the depths of bird banding is like you find all of us molt nerds who are like, yay. And it's just so cool because even like I'll be birding and I'll be like, that bird retained a couple like of these feathers. I'm like, oh, I wish I could hold it. Like it's always funny because it's like usually the ones where I just see some sort of weird molt and I'm like, oh, I wish I could see that up close. Like that would be so cool. So there's definitely that. The funny thing is though, is I know a lot of people, and so it seems like anytime I travel, I usually meet someone who is like, oh, like you want to come bird banding? Like, well, actually, so a friend of mine invited me to the UK because she was going to a conference, and she's like, "You want to just show up a week early with me? We can like hang out, hit some clubs." And I was like, "Sure, why not?" And so, and then I told these friends of mine, I was like, "Yeah, I'm gonna go to the UK," and they're like, "You're going to the UK?" And I was like, "Yeah, I don't know, it just sounded fun." And they're like, "You want to go ringing?" And I was like, "Sure." And so they gave me a bunch of contacts, and so like my first, I got there like the day before my friend. And I just like hit all these people up and they're like, yeah, come on out. And so I got in. I was like terribly jet lagged, but I was like, I'm gonna wake up at 5 a.m. and go ringing. And I did. And then I got to ring a swan. I got to ring a like mute swan. I was like, wow, this is wild. So it is funny. I do feel like anywhere I end up going birding, I like inevitably know somebody who invites me banding. And I'm like, well, it's not a bad thing.
Your friend, you're just like, yeah, we're not gonna make it to the clubs. I got other stuff I'm doing.
I know I was trying to keep up a schedule of like, can I stay out till 3 a.m., go to sleep for an hour, and then wake up an hour later and go ring a bearded tit? Yes. It worked for like 2 nights, and then I was way too tired.
Yeah, that's awesome. My other question was, is there like just a birding destination that you really want to go to? Like, what's next on your list?
Oh, man. I have. Oh, like so I've done a ton of travel in Latin America, and that's definitely like a lot of like my specialty and my passion is neotropical ornithology, but I am really dying to see more of the other side of the ocean. I really want to get over to like Africa. Like I've heard Namibia is really cool. I've heard Namibia is really awesome for birding. I've heard South Africa is really cool. So I'd love to get somewhere in Africa. I'd also love to do some stuff like Southeast Asia. Like birding anywhere over there, seeing a broadbill would be super rad. Seeing some of the, I got a little taste. I was in Tahiti, in September for like a family trip because my sister did a sailing across the ocean thing. So we all, my parents and my other sister, we went and met her up with her, and I got to see the society kingfisher, an Asian kingfisher. I'm a crassiform fan, if you haven't picked that up, but Asian kingfishers, a lot of them just act totally different. Like they're not like loud and clacking around by creeks. They're just kind of like chilling in the forest, like super quiet. So I'm like, I need to see more Asian kingfishers now. Like they just seem so, or at least my one experience, that's what it seemed like. So I shouldn't assume. But I would really love to see more kingfishers and
Nice.
bee eaters. Yeah.
Is there a bird that you really want to band that you haven't banded yet?
Ooh, oh, wow, what a question. Oh man. Well, I would love to ban the Puerto Rican toady because they would be, I'd just be curious because to compare it with my other toady banding experiences is the only toady I have not banded. So that would be a cool one. Oh man, I don't know. I don't have a good answer to that one. Like any birds are just cool to man. Like I love getting like motmots are really cool, or like the birds that are really fun are like woodpeckers because they can just do like crazy wild molt patterns and you're like, what are you doing? And so and that's I think why I love birding and banding in the tropics is like in the tropics, like in the North America you have like the pile guide to aging birds who kind of like have this rough guide of like what to look for when you're trying to have a bird in the hand. And you do have the guide or the Molta Neotropical Birds Guide, but it really just works for like the Brazilian Amazon. So it's just cool because like a lot of it's just kind of like uncharted territory. So you just like catch a bird and you're like, oh, what do we see? So I don't know. It's just like any of it's really excited. Being here, I really in Grenada, I really want to catch the melanistic banana quits. I really want to see what they're doing. That seems really cool. And it would actually like we have a very special protocol in place. But if we were to catch a Grenada dove, that would be pretty special because I don't really think anyone's banded. I think some like somebody's banded one, but it would be really cool to start to get some measurements and some data on them.
Yeah, I don't think there's really been much research on them as far as I know. Or really
Yeah.
much like it does, I don't know, aside from people on the island, I don't hear it talked about much about,
Yeah, I
people
know
worried
Birds
about them.
Caribbean. Trying to like Birds Caribbean's doing some work trying to promote them and yeah it's like a critically endangered dove and like the mongoose problem's been really bad so I know some people take the forestry department they're starting some more mongoose removal work soon so with Birds Caribbean so but yeah I really don't feel like it's talked about much outside of the Caribbean.
Yeah, you know about the invasive frog?
No, actually I don't.
So at night you might be hearing all these like squeaky bike tire frog noises. Those are
Yes, I hear some of them now.
non-native. So there's a native
Oh,
Grenada
yeah.
tree frog. They're very quiet, so like at night it would be very calm. And then when that invasive one came in, now it sounds like the squeaky bike tire all the time.
Whoa. Oh, is the Grenada frog still around then, or did it
I
get
think
out
they're still
completely?
around. When I was
Okay.
there, we had people from the Milwaukee County Zoo come out, and they were doing research on like the
Oh, cool.
Grenada native one versus the invasive one. I think it's still around.
Cool.
Yeah, it's
I hope
endemic.
so.
Yeah, it's endemic. So that's cool. So if you make it out, and they have the Grenada tree boas too.
Oh, cool. That would be way fun to see.
Yeah, so we would when I went there, it was to do scuba diving research on the reefs, but we would go out at night sometimes with the crew and catch tree boas, and then we'd do like forest survey, like coverage, and then we'd also look for frogs and stuff at night. It was cool. So if you get a chance to do that, it's pretty
Ooh.
neat experience.
Yeah, I dove the other day and I was incredibly impressed. The reef here is just beautiful. Like I was diving in the DR a few weeks back and they're doing a lot of restoration work, which is awesome, but there's just still a lot of bleaching and like it's just kind of sad. But these three was it was gorgeous. Like it was so colorful and like the places we dove, I was like, wow, it's amazing here.
How
But
was
yeah, I'll
that?
have to go.
How was the
What?
algae? When we were there was a ton of macroalgae taken over. Was it pretty cleaned
Whoa.
off or was it
Yeah,
pretty
no,
covered?
I didn't see much at all, honestly.
Good. Awesome.
But I did two dives, so at least there is I went to.
Neat. So I guess one last question.
Okay.
How'd you get into all this to begin with?
My origin story. It's actually kind of a funny story. So I was like this super nerdy kid that I was like into birds from a young age. So when I was like 7, 8, I was into birds. And I think it's like I grew up in Colorado and I grew up in this like mountain valley where there was like a pond. So I think my mom was like always taking me to see the ducks. And so I was kind of like struck by the ducks and stuff. And a friend of mine, her parents were birders or yeah, are birders. And so they would take us out birding. They'd take us to like Bar Lake. And it was funny too, because so her dad, he would always call binoculars field glasses. And so we'd be like, oh, like lift up your field glasses and like let's look at the Western Kingbird. And I would be like, ooh, cool. And my friend, we get so embarrassed. She'd be like, Dad, like I can't believe you're calling it field glasses. And then she'd be like, I can't even be around you. And so me and her dad would be like nerding out. And then she'd be like, ah, I can't be seen with you guys. And so, and then it was. So it was just pretty funny. But then her parents took me and my family to Monte Vista in Southern Colorado to go experience the sandhill crane migration. And so when we were there, they worked for the state of Colorado, so they knew some wildlife biologists, and they were like, "Hey, do you guys want to check out duck banding?" And so I was like 10 years old, and I got to band my first bird, which was a duck, which is not many people get to say that. So that was pretty special. And after that, I was like, "Oh, I'm sold." And I was telling everyone, I was like, "I'm gonna be an ornithologist when I grow up. Like, this is my calling." And I mean, it's here I am, right? And what's really cool too is they had always wanted to go to Costa Rica and see like quetzals. And so last year, my partner and I, because my partner is a bird guide, and so we organized a trip for them in Costa Rica to do like a little bird tour. And so it's just kind of like this really cool full circle where like they really helped get me into birds. They really helped foster like this nerdy kid loving birds. And so then we got to like take them all over Costa Rica, and they just absolutely loved it. So, and my friend came too, and she's like starting to get into birds too. So yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Nate, do you know if your friend's dad still calls him field glasses? I
I
hope he
actually,
does. I hope he carries it on.
I think he does sometimes. It's like, yeah, it's hilarious. He's like, yeah, he's a great guy.
Well, cool. And it's neat you mentioned the full circle moment because now you're posting stuff about banning on social media, so maybe that'll spark some other 10-year-old, or you get some 10-year-old that you're banning stuff and they'll get into it the same way that you did.
Yeah, it's really cool actually. Like, actually someone just messaged me and they wanted to send me some questions for their like Girl Scout badge, I want to say, and they're like, "We need to interview an ornithologist." And I was like, "I'd love to." So yeah, I always feel like I want to give back because I remember when I was a kid and I would go to these like Audubon bird walks, and I would be like the youngest person by 70 years, and I was like, "What? Like, are there like no young people who are into this?" And so I feel like finding young birders and that young birding community, and like even just talking to like young professionals who are like, "How did you get into this?" Because honestly, didn't I had no idea how to get into this really, to like get into like ornithology and the science of it. So I like anytime someone messages me on Instagram, they're like, "How do you do it?" I'm like, "Here you go." Like I just always try to give back that way.
Yeah, wonderful. Did you have anything else to add?
Oh, the only other thing I wanted to add with the one thing I was thinking about. So with the one of the cool things that we've done with the Caribbean Bird Banding Network, to just like bring that back full circle, because you were mentioning how at the beginning with the band, a lot of times it's like a USGS or like a band issued by the US government. So what actually we've done, so those bands, to get into some quick banding knowledge, those bands can actually only be used on North American birds. So you can use those bands on migrants, but you can't use them on resident birds. So part of what we've done with Birds Caribbean is we wanted to create a banding schema that could work for everything. And so we actually put our own stamp that says Birds Carib, and it has our own website that says bcbnb.org. And so what we wanted to do is we wanted to create a banding schema that would work for resident birds and migratory birds, where people could just, it would be way more easily accessible. So I was thinking about that, and that was just one more thing I wanted to add in. So.
Neat. Awesome. Well, make sure if you guys are interested, check out orn.ecology on Instagram. You can see some cool birds in the hand, and you can see people's comments on Holly's hands and fingernails. But don't put those on yourself, but they're there. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us, Holly.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on. This is a ton of fun.
Yeah, and thanks everyone for watching this episode of the Badgerland Birding Podcast.